KingCancerHistory.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with about one of the most frightening books you're likely to read about global warming. And later, is President Trump changing the nature of U.S. politics permanently? Or is he an aberration? We'll discuss that in the second part of today's show. Our first guest is David Wallace Wells, whose new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, is a shocking expose of what conditions will be like on planet Earth if global warming continues at the current pace. Wallace Wells is deputy editor at New York Magazine, and he joins us live right now. David Wallace Wells, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to talk with you.
So let me ask you, this is a frightening book. Do you think that we're on track to having an uninhabitable Earth?
It depends on what timeline you're talking about, but I think generally speaking, true uninhabitability of the planet is going to be so far in the future that it doesn't really make sense to think about. But I think as soon as the end of this century, when we could have global temperature rise of about 4 degrees Celsius, we're at about 1.1 degrees right now. I think at 4 degrees, large parts of the planet would be uninhabitable, and there are parts of the planet that would be uninhabitable as soon as 2 degrees. You know, many of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East are estimated to become so hot in summer as soon as 2050 at 2 degrees that walking around outside, certainly working around outside during summer, would risk heat stroke and possibly death, which means that a lot of people looking at that data believe that those cities will be, practically speaking, unlivable as soon as the middle of the century, and some of them hold as many as 10 or 12 or 15 million people. I think it's also likely that in face of conditions like those, we adapt and we figure out new ways to live such that 2 degrees wouldn't necessarily mean the wholesale migration of all those hundreds of millions of people living in that part of the world. But I think we're right around the corner from some impacts that even looking at them today, we would find unlivable, unhappy, unconscionable. Whether or not a few decades from now we find ways to live in those scenarios, I think considering them now, they would seem, you know, too uncomfortable to really happily inhabit.
So it's not just the rise of the seas, it's the temperatures outside becoming so hot it makes it impossible to live in some areas of the world.
Yeah, you know, there is a natural limit to what kind of heat and humidity the human body can take. And globally, while we're very far from that level now, there are parts of the planet that could reach that level somewhat regularly in relatively short order if we don't change course on warming. But, you know, that's you mentioned sea level rise, the direct heat effects are a second impact, but really there are dozens of other ones that are just as concerning. In my book, I write about the economic impacts. It's estimated that by 2100, if we don't change course, we could have a global GDP that's 30% smaller than it would be without climate change. That's an impact that's twice as deep as the Great Depression, and it would be permanent. I talk about the relationship between temperature and conflict, which suggests that if we end up again on the track that we're on, 4 degrees by the end of the century, we could have twice as much war as we have today. We could have places on the planet that are hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once. We could have agricultural yields that were only half as bountiful as they are today, and we'd be using them to feed 50% more people. There are public health impacts where just the difference between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees, it's been estimated, could kill 153 million additional people through the effects of air pollution, which has impacts even when people don't die because it affects cognitive performance, it affects the development of children, development of babies in utero, the rates of autism and ADHD and schizophrenia and other mental illnesses. There really isn't any feature of modern life, of social life, that will be unaffected if we let this system run its course. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the main factor there is what we do. The main driver of climate change is human action, which means we can choose to push less of it or do more of it. And, you know, as scary as some of these outcomes are, as sort of paralyzingly large as they may seem, ultimately they're also a reminder of just how much power we have over this climate, because we will be driving those changes if they happen. And as a result, I think ultimately it may sound sort of perverse, but it's a bit of a empowering lesson. These are not sagas or impacts that are unfolding beyond our control. They're unfolding precisely because of what we do, which means, conceivably at least, we could change course now.
Our guest is David Wallace Wells. His book is The Uninhabitable Earth, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. There's a passage in your book where you describe what it's like to die from overheating. Could you describe what it is like to die from overheating?
Well, I think it's probably easiest to think of as hypothermia in reverse. You know, we're used to that picture of death by cold, but we haven't really thought that much about what death by heat stroke looks like. But functionally, it's the same. At first you sweat a lot, then you stop sweating. The blood in your body retreats from the extremities. Some of the heat then starts to cause organ failure. And at a certain point, either because of the failure of those organs, possibly a heart attack, you have a lethal event. It's not pretty. But the truth is, climate change will impose an enormous amount of suffering short of death all around the world. There are parts of the planet already, it's been estimated, that have lost as much as 30% or 40% of their potential GDP over the past decades because of climate change. It's speculated that much of the phenomenon of Islamic terrorism that we've seen over the last few decades and more broadly the social disarray that's sweeping through the Middle East is at least partly caused by climate change, because climate change produces more droughts, which produces more famine, which produces political instability. And the migration crisis that we're seeing really throughout Africa and the Middle East is quite directly a response to that, as is the migration crisis that we're seeing in Central America. Many of the migrants moving northward up to Mexico and ultimately to the United States are doing so in part because of social disarray that has been produced by climate change in their home countries. And unfortunately, that's likely to continue and even get considerably worse over the next few decades. The UN estimates that by 2050, we'll have as many as 200 million climate refugees. They think that it's possible we could have as many as 1 billion, which is as many people as live in North and South America combined today. And while I think those estimates are a little high, even if you take the low number, 200 million, and divide it in half, you get 100 million, which is 100 times as big as the Syrian refugee crisis, which has completely destabilized European politics and through Europe sort of destabilized global politics. So that gives you a sense of just how far-reaching and cascading some of these impacts can be. You know, we tend to think of climate change as being a series of discrete threats, say sea level rise or wildfires. But what's even more concerning is the way that some of these impacts make one another worse. And then when you add up the whole picture, you really see that this is not something that you can escape no matter where you live or how wealthy you are. Because it's an all-encompassing threat. There will be impacts everywhere. You know, right in the middle of America, you might have thought, I'm not going to be affected by sea level rise, but you're seeing historic floods that have inundated, even drowned, huge parts of a number of states over the last few months and made those farmers' lives much more difficult. In California, much of Southern California has for the last half century, three quarters of a century, put itself forward as a kind of paradise on earth where the world's wealthiest and most famous people can live both in a kind of communion with nature and in a way that was the kind of epitome of modern life. But you see with the wildfires that have been ravaging that part of the country over the last few years, that kind of that was really a delusion, and that no matter where you are, again, no matter how wealthy you are, no matter what country you live in, climate change is going to affect people in different ways, and the global South will suffer more than those of us living in the West. But the California wildfires teach us that, you know, if the Kardashians have to evacuate and Rupert Murdoch has to evacuate, probably there aren't many people who are going to be entirely safe from this from this saga in the coming decades.
Our guest is David Wallace Wells, and his new book is a shocking expose of what conditions will be like on planet Earth if global warming continues at the current pace. Just getting back to make it clear, you're saying that those Syrian refugees that have changed the politics in Europe, they're not just leaving Syria because of the civil war, they're leaving because the climate has changed in Syria?
No, that the climate caused in part the civil war. You know, it's careful to say this is not that war was not exclusively a phenomenon of climate change. In Lebanon, they had the same climate effects and did not have a civil war. But when you have famine and drought, it destabilizes politics generally, and that means that some countries are going to fall into true disarray. Other countries will find ways to endure without falling into that kind of decline. But when you look globally, when you know that the rates of drought and famine are going to, and extreme weather are going to be increasing everywhere, that means that you're just pushing more pressure on more countries every year, and some portion of them are likely to succumb to those pressures and fall into some kind of state of disarray or civil war, which is what happened in Syria. You know, I like to think of it with in an analogy with extreme weather and hurricanes. You know, when meteorologists look at a particular hurricane, they have a hard time saying this storm was climate change because we had hurricanes before climate change. But the fact that we're seeing so many more of them, and that they're so much more intense, when you look at the big picture, you know that climate change is what's driving that change. And it's the same when you look at social disorder and civil war. It's not that any single event, any single war, any single conflict is exclusively the creation of civil war. But globally speaking, the more that these societies are strained by these climate impacts, the more of them are going to fall into some state of disarray, and that's, you know, deeply problematic.
The book is The Uninhabitable Earth. It's just come out. Its author, David Wallace Wells, is live with us, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So I know you spent at least 3 years looking at the research on climate change and global warming. Did you find that there was much dissent, and you know, do most scientists agree that this is the direction the Earth is headed? And then the second question is, the skeptics say, well, look, scientists are only employed if they agree with the theory of global warming. If you don't agree with that theory, you're not employed or you're not getting grants. What would you say to those two questions?
In general, I would say that everyone I've ever met in this area agrees that global warming is happening, and that includes some people who would describe themselves as climate skeptics or people who are reluctant to take large-scale action, of whom there are a somewhat significant number. But the temperature record is inarguable. The planet is warmer than it's ever been in the entire history of humanity. That means that we are now walking on a planet that is hotter than any planet ever walked on by humans before us. And as a result, I think you can start to think about, it's an open question, just how much we can rely on all the things that we've thought of as permanent features of modern life, of human life, as enduring in this new climate situation, because we are now entirely outside the window of temperatures that enclose all of human history, the whole evolution of the species, the development of agriculture, the development of civilization, the rise of modernity, modern capitalism, everything about we know about the modern age, all of that happened under climate conditions that no longer prevail. So it's almost like we've landed on a new planet with a new set of climate conditions, and we're trying to figure out now just how many of those things that we've brought with us will survive. Now, I think we are a resilient, adaptable species. I think we will find ways to live on this new planet, even as it continues to change quite rapidly. But I do think it will leave its fingerprints on us, because the climate conditions really are that different. And the planet is warming. It's not just that we know that the planet's warming. It's that it's warming at exactly the rate, at exactly the pace, on exactly the curve that you could have predicted using only the extremely rudimentary understanding of the greenhouse effect that was first discovered in the mid-19th century. If you took that model that John Tyndall and Eunice Foote developed in the 1850s and input just the extra carbon that we know is in the atmosphere today, you would get a prediction matching just about precisely as much temperature rise as we've gotten to this point. So I think from a scientific perspective, it's basically inarguable that this is happening, and it's also inarguable that it's happening because of what we're doing, which is to say putting more carbon into the atmosphere. Now, there are also natural cycles that are unfolding. They have some impact, but I think it's important to keep in mind that no natural cycle has ever been this dramatic at any point in human history. The ones that were this dramatic in the past meant huge, what are called mass extinctions, some of which meant as many as 95% of all life on Earth dying, and a complete transformation of the planet's ecosystems and habitats such that the last time there was this much carbon in the air, there were palm trees in the Arctic, and the equator was unlivable for anything that we would think of as mammal life today. So what we're triggering with the extra carbon we're putting into the atmosphere is really, really quite scary. Now, remind me of the second part of your question about deniers and skeptics.
Well, the deniers would, you know, they say that only the people who are employed and getting grants are the ones that already agree with climate change or global warming.
There's an enormous funding apparatus for climate skeptics and climate deniers in the think tank world. In the money that actually moves on that side of the aisle is much more significant. And I think it's notable that almost all of those people who have signed up for that kind of advocacy are not, credentialed scientists from major institutions. Now, you could say that those institutions, the major research institutions of the U.S. and the rest of the world, are biased in the direction of believing in the fact of global warming. And I think to a certain degree, that is true in the sense that they don't take seriously arguments that climate change is not happening because they understand climate change to be happening. But I think when you look globally, it is obviously our interest, our emotional interest, our psychological interest, our political interest to not have this be happening. All of our lives would be happier, less worried. Our sense of the future would be less troubled and more optimistic if we were not if we weren't facing a quite dramatic threat from climate change. And so I think that talking about the incentive structure here at the level of university jobs is quite a bit misleading. If there was any reason to believe that the world was not facing an existential crisis, I think the world would choose to would choose to believe that. I think that we would all be happier and more comfortable if we weren't facing this kind of crisis. And we have all, as a result, have impulses and reflexes that make us look for more optimistic scenarios, more optimistic research. And I think you see that actually in all of the media coverage about climate change over the last decade or two, which has been, there has been some fear-mongering as part of it. But the balance of scary news to happy news in the media is really quite a bit lower than the ratio of scary news to happy news in the academic research, which, as I review it, is, I probably read 50 or 100 papers that make me revise my understanding of the future in a darker direction for every one that I see that makes me revise it in a more optimistic direction. And I think, to me, that's testimony to the strength of the science, because in the same way that we'd all want to believe that the future was bright and world peace was around the corner, none of us want to believe in global warming. The fact that all of those who look most closely at it do is a sign of just how overwhelming that evidence really is.
The book is The Uninhabitable Earth. Its author, David Wallace Wells, is with us. I think, David, in the New York Times a few weeks ago, you wrote, it's time to freak out. But has there been any difference made? Some countries, like Norway, have switched to almost all electric cars. Canada has a big wind turbine effort going on. Here in the U.S., people are voluntarily buying Teslas and that sort of thing. Since the knowledge about climate change and global warming has risen, have we done anything to reduce carbon dioxide emissions into the air?
Well, we've taken some steps at a kind of rhetorical policy level, I would say. We've made progress in making renewable energy much cheaper in much of the world. It's now cheaper than dirty energy. It will be cheaper than dirty energy in all parts of the world in short order. And there are all around the world commitments to reducing emissions of the kind that you mentioned about, pushing electric cars or subsidizing renewable energy and that kind of thing. But looking at the global picture, every year is the worst year for emissions on record. We're doing worse every year than the year before. And half of all of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels in the entire history of humanity have come in the last 30 years. Which is since Al Gore published his first book on warming. It's since the UN established its IPCC climate change body. And that's especially troubling because it means that we've done more damage to the planet knowingly than we ever managed in ignorance. The Paris Accords were signed just 3 years ago now, not quite 3 years ago, but it's summer of 2016. Those accords committed the nations of the world rhetorically to staying below 2 2 degrees Celsius, which is a level of warming that the scientists of the world call threshold of catastrophe, and the island nations of the world call genocide. It would mean probably the permanent loss of all the world's ice sheets, which could eventually bring 250 feet of sea level rise. It would mean the direct heat effects that we mentioned earlier, where major cities in South Asia and the Middle East would become unlivable, would have devastating consequence to agriculture and river flooding. That's what the Paris Accords call on us to achieve, 2 degrees of warming. So it's a kind of a best-case scenario. But the Accords only included commitments from each individual nation that added together would get us to about 3.2 degrees. So we said, we're going to try to get to 2 degrees, but here are the things we're going to do, and if you add up the math of those commitments, they only get us about halfway to 2 degrees. They get us to about 3.2 degrees, where things would be considerably worse. More importantly, I think, is that no nation in the world is on track to meet those commitments just 3 years later. And that, to me, signals just how complicated it is going to be to solve this problem. Over the last few decades, you know, I mentioned earlier, we've made renewable energy much, much, much cheaper, to the point where it now makes more sense in almost all cases to invest in renewable energy rather than dirty energy. And yet, the renewable share of our global energy use has not grown at all in 40 years. We've responded to this news by all of this new affordable green energy by simply adding to our energy capacity. And that's why, you know, 30 years after we really knew for sure that this was happening and we need to change course, we're just making the problem worse every year.
David, I know we're almost out of time. Let me ask you one last question. Adam writes this, and I want to add on to it. Adam writes, please mention the Asian cities that will be at risk as early as 2050. What are the top three areas or cities that are most at risk? That's Adam's question. Let me just add to it. You name in your book all these areas that will be changed forever because of global warming that we will no longer see, or things will disappear. Could you give us just part of the list of what's going to disappear by 2050?
Well, by 2050, you're talking about cities in the Middle East like Calcutta, Mumbai, and you won't be able to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca. It'll be too hot in the summer for that. But there's also the problem of air pollution, which is killing as many as 1 million Indians a year already. Globally, is killing 9 million people a year. And the features of the world that will change beyond that, as soon as 2050, you know, again, a lot of this is up to what we do, because the warming level that we could see at 2050 is quite variable. The main determinant of that is what kind of action we take on carbon emissions. But assuming that we go forward without changing course at all, it's assumed that all of the world's coral reefs will die. Much of Bangladesh will be underwater. Probably much of Miami Beach will be underwater. The Mediterranean will, by that point, probably have passed into being a true desert climate, as opposed to what's now called the Mediterranean climate. And the wildfires in California are likely to be at least twice as bad and probably four times as bad as they've been in the last few years, when they were the worst years for fire on record, burning more than 1 million acres each year, and destroying thousands of homes, thousands of buildings every time. Those are just a few of the impacts, but, you know, it's also estimated that mosquitoes that used to be limited to the tropics will be flying as far north as the Arctic, which means that all of those diseases they carry with them would be now transmittable in ecosystems that before used to be totally resistant to them. There are the agricultural impacts that I mentioned, where for every degree of warming, you get about a 10 or 20% decrease in agricultural yields. So at 2 degrees in 2050, you could have probably agricultural yields that were 30, 40% smaller than they are today. And there are, you know, impacts, like I said, really everywhere you look. The whole face of the planet would change. And I often say the face of the planet will change no matter what happens, because even if we were miraculously avoid some of these devastating impacts, it will mean such a aggressive response that we will be changing the world through our response. It will mean, you know, a planet plastered with solar panels and carbon capture machines. It will mean an entirely different way of raising agriculture and animal proteins. It will mean new transportation, new kinds of airplanes. It will mean new kinds of industry and infrastructure. And so whatever we do in the coming decades, climate change will change the face of modern life. I think it will be the dominant story of the 21st century. I think the most sort of interesting and original part of my book is not walking through the science, although it does that too. It's thinking through what it will mean for our politics and our geopolitics, our relationship to economics and technology, our sense of history, whether we have faith in progress. All of these questions I think of as the kind of humanities of climate change, which may ultimately be as profound or more profound than the direct climate impacts. That is how big a story this is. It's at a level that we used to only recognize in mythology and theology, and we're living through it, walking through it ourselves as protagonists today. The changes are incredibly dramatic. The story is enormous, and the time is now for action.
And your book is a call to action. David Wallace Wells, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Good to have you
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
David Wallace Wells is the author of the brand new book, The Uninhabitable Earth. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. Is Donald Trump an aberration, or is he the future of politics in America? Stay tuned. Young and Crazy Horse here on WMNF in Tampa. Well, our next guest is Paul Starr. Paul is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the co-founder and founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction and the Bancroft Prize in American history. He's out with a new book called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. The topic of entrenchment comes up in an article he's written in this month's Atlantic, where he asks, is Trumpism a temporary aberration or a long-term phenomenon? Put another way, will the changes brought about by Donald Trump in today's Republican Party fade away, or will they become entrenched? Here to answer that question is Paul Starr, who joins us on the phone. Paul, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Delighted to be with you.
Paul, let me ask you, what is entrenchment, first of all?
So by entrenchment, I mean hard-to-reverse changes. Changes often in the basic rules of the game and the foundations of society. Changes that once made are really tough to undo. So, you know, we have ordinary politics where, you know, things zig one way, they zag the next. The budget goes up, the budget goes down. That's normal politics. That's what we're used to most of the time. But then there are times when the changes really have very long-lasting consequences that are going to be very hard to undo. And we're at a moment like that, I think, when the country does, in fact, face these kinds of big choices.
Could you go back in history and give us an example where either U.S. history or the history of another country where some sort of entrenchment happened, where things remained pretty much stable? That was the policy for years and years and years, or decades or centuries?
Sure. So let's take a very clear-cut example, an example also that illustrates both sides of this. There can be good aspects to entrenchment. There couldn't be bad aspects. It may depend on your view of things. So a constitution is a good example of entrenchment. We still have the same constitution that our founders adopted in 1787. And that constitution entrenched certain very important and valuable aspects of our government. Unfortunately, at the same time, it also entrenched certain protections for slavery. And slavery continued to exist in the United States, you know, until the Civil War. So that's what I mean by a moment when there are choices with these kinds of lasting fundamental consequences.
With Donald Trump, I don't know what kind of Republican he is. How would you describe what his... I mean, he's not a libertarian, or maybe you think that there are libertarian aspects of him. He's not a Jeb Bush Republican or kind of an old-style traditional Republican, country club Republican that they used to call him back in the 1960s. What does he represent? What kind of change do you think he represents?
Well, I think he's brought a kind of authoritarian populism into the Republican Party. And a very different frame, but at the same time, the tax legislation that Republicans passed and Trump signed is really just old-fashioned tax-cutting legislation that provides most of the benefits to the very wealthy. There wasn't really anything new about that. There wasn't, I think, anything very populist about that. His Supreme Court appointments so far have been totally in line with what conservatives want. And so I think, just coming back to this idea of entrenchment, right now we have a Supreme Court that's sort of it's a 5-4 conservative court. There are times when one of the conservative justices sides with the liberals. That used to be Anthony Kennedy quite regularly. Just this past week, Justice Kavanaugh surprisingly sided with liberals on an antitrust case, very important case involving Apple. If Trump is reelected, I suspect he will have the chance to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, perhaps also Stephen Breyer, and we might well go from a 5-4 court to a 7-2 court, in which case no lone dissenter from the conservative side will ever give the liberals a chance to win. Now, if you're a supporter of the conservative side, that's a good thing. From a liberal side, and that's my side of this, this is an example of entrenchment. This would be a shift that would last for a very long time, and it would bring about, I think, rather more fundamental changes in the way our society works than what we've seen so far with a 5-4 majority.
Our guest is Paul Starr. He's a professor at Princeton University, and he's the co-founder and founding co-editor of American Prospect magazine. He's out with a new book called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies, published by Yale University Press. You think President Trump has a really good chance of getting reelected. Why?
Well, I said it's a 50-50 situation. It's a toss-up. And here I'm just, going with what a number of political analysts have said. On the one hand, you have public opinion data that shows that he's been underwater, that more people have disapproved than approved of him as president. On the other hand, the economy is in relatively good shape. That is usually a strong factor in predicting the outcome of presidential elections. It's unclear. I just say there's a real possibility that President Trump will be reelected. I don't know what the outcome will be. And what I'm trying to emphasize in that article in The Atlantic is how big the stakes are. So let me just mention another issue that I think really has very lasting consequences, and that has to do with climate change. And if the United States doesn't get to doing anything about climate until the late 2020s, it's going to become increasingly difficult to keep global warming below 2 degrees centigrade of warming. That's the target that was set in the Paris Agreement, and we get on a path that could well become really irreversible. That become you could reach a point of no return, this may seem like apocalyptic talk, but really there's a lot of science behind this, that's another area where we could see this irreversible kind of a change, and that's what I'm concerned about. It's about reversibility. So in normal politics, things get reversed. You have a term of one party, okay, a term of another party, but there are these moments when really the stakes are very high, and I think that's what we're approaching in 2020.
And I want to ask you about one of those other areas, nuclear arms, in just a second. Our guest is Paul Starr. The book is Entrenchment, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. But before we go there, the president right now is thumbing his nose at subpoenas that are being sent to his staff and former staff members and to his administration by the Congress. Is that what you mean by authoritarian populism? And if the president is successful, does that kind of cement this idea of authoritarian populism?
So I don't know that that is specifically populist. It is, I think, connected to a certain pattern of authoritarianism, of not respecting the constitutional norms, the rules that we have traditionally had, in this case, powers of Congress, including the powers of oversight, that other presidents have respected. They haven't tried to prevent members of their administration from testifying. They haven't refused legal requests for documents and so forth. So yeah, this is the kind of arbitrary one-person rule that is, I think, very concerning. We have had a division of powers, a separation of powers, a balance between the legislature and the executive, and there's a real question here of whether Congress will be able to exert its appropriate powers.
Now, one of the ideas that you bring up, and you brought up in your article in The Atlantic, is nuclear weapons. President Trump has a very different attitude towards nuclear weapons, and his positions on nuclear weapons I don't think have been widely discussed, especially on those TV shows that some of us watch endlessly, debating Russiagate and the Mueller report. But what has the president done on nuclear weapons, and why does that alarm you?
Okay, so I don't think many people appreciate how significant the arms agreements have been. Since President Reagan and Gorbachev struck the first of those agreements, back in 1986, I believe, and over these many decades since the late 1980s, the United States and originally the Soviet Union, now Russia, eliminated 90% of their nuclear arsenals. We've actually had some very considerable success. And President Trump has unilaterally withdrawn the United States from one of those agreements. There's no sign that he's interested in renewing another one of them. We may soon see the end of all the arms control agreements that have really kept in check the arms race in recent decades. And there's more to this than that. It's this also the general America First posture, the rejection of America's traditional alliances. These have created a lot of uncertainty in our allies as to whether the United States would come to their defense. And so there is rumbling all over the world about this, a potential renewed arms race, threats of nuclear proliferation, and that risks accidents, it risks instability, it ultimately risks war. And I don't think people widely appreciate how significant these developments have been.
So the U.S. is no longer going into Russia and inspecting their nuclear arsenal and vice versa? Russia's not coming into the U.S. and inspecting our arsenals?
Well, we have one remaining agreement, the New START agreement, that expires in 2021. But what would happen if that expires? And as I said, there's no sign that the Trump administration is interested in renewing that. Yeah, that would be the end of these inspections that have been going on for decades. And that also creates uncertainty about what the other country is up to and what its capabilities are. The regime that we've had, the arms control regime that we've had, has really helped to maintain a certain degree of stability and confidence. And I'm worried about what will happen internationally if we see this breakdown, and it goes along, as I said, with a lot of other things. Once you get an arms race going, it's hard to bring it back.
Would other countries then, who currently don't have nuclear weapons, be interested in making nuclear weapons if the U.S. or Russia no longer have their treaties limiting nuclear weapons?
So I think the most immediate concern is about Saudi Arabia. I think there's also stirring in Japan now. Japan, which has a constitutional limit on nuclear arms, but growing impatience, worried again about whether the United States will maintain the defense agreements that it has had in the past. And again, so, you know, if there's just one term for Donald Trump, other countries will say, okay, that was an exception. The United States has returned to its traditional position in defense of its allies. But I think with two terms, that's much less likely. And other countries will just see that they have to fend for themselves. And I think that's what's going to ignite a new arms race.
Our guest is Paul Starr. He's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, and he's out with a new book called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. He's also the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, Paul, let me just say, give you an anecdote and get your take on this. I went to the first Trump rally that was held here in Tampa. That was long before the primary election, and it was a big crowd. It was at the local university, probably 10,000 to 12,000 people turned out. A lot of my friends are reporters, so we were roaming the hallway looking for elected officials, and we couldn't find any elected officials, any elected Republican officials in the room. There might have been some there, but back in 2015, the Republican establishment stayed away from Trump. And now I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party is the Trump Party. So could the Republican Party ever go back to what it was before Trump?
Oh, that's a great question. And really the question there is whether Trumpism itself is now entrenched in the Republican Party. At this point, it may look that way. I'm not so sure that it is. I think it depends on whether it depends on the outcome of the 2020 election. If the 2020 election is like the 2018 election, I don't think that is going to be true. But really, at this point, the Republican base has been loyal to Trump. And Republicans who have offended Trump have not done very well in primaries, and so he's been able to exert control over the party. I'm really not sure what would happen in the event that Trump loses in 2020.
Well, one of the other significant changes that you mentioned a few minutes ago, and that is that if the president does get a second term, he could change the Supreme Court, and instead of having a 5-4 conservative majority, he could have a 7-2 conservative majority if just two justices resign, Ginsburg and Breyer, or Breyer rather. Talk about the impact of that for future generations, and do you think that some of those conservatives might get a little uncomfortable having these 7-2 votes if Trump is reelected and he's able to pack the Supreme Court?
Oh, I don't know why they'd be uncomfortable. They would enjoy a very comfortable majority. I think one of the key areas, I think, look at is what would happen to the federal government's regulatory powers. For example, environmental regulation. A lot of those powers go back to changes in constitutional doctrine that were made during the 1930s and the following decades. It's often described as the New Deal Revolution that extended the economic, regulatory, and other powers of the federal government under the Commerce Clause. And I think it's quite possible with a 7-2 majority, the conservatives would sharply roll back the federal government's regulatory powers. Now, I think many conservatives would be very happy about that. Other people would be very disturbed about that. For example, what about that issue I mentioned earlier, climate change, and the kinds of regulation that we now have or could have that would help reduce carbon emissions and reduce the contribution our country is making to the rising global temperatures and rising sea levels. So, you know, if we had that kind of change in the Supreme Court, it might make it much more difficult to deal with climate change in the future.
Now, you point out that conservatives have been training people and being really good about creating a network, the Federalist Society being the most prominent group of lawyers here in Central Florida. There's a strong Federalist Society. I think liberals have started something called the Constitution Society. You got to correct me if I'm wrong, but to try to create their own legal network. But the Federalist Society is so far ahead of that's the conservative jurist society. The conservatives are so far ahead of the liberals that the liberals are not going to catch up anytime soon in creating their own network of future judges.
Yeah, so this is a big change from 30, 40 years ago. If Trump is reelected, he might have a total of 4 Supreme Court nominations. And the last president who had 4 nominations was Richard Nixon. But if you look at Nixon's nominees, not all of them were as ideologically conservative as recent Republican Supreme Court nominees. And that's partly because the country wasn't as polarized. The legal community wasn't as polarized. Judges weren't as polarized. But now things have changed, and both sides have become, as you say, much more organized. And so it's much less likely that a president of one party or the other appoints justices who end up having views more in the middle.
If these changes could become monumental if President Trump gets a second term, is there potential for pushback? I'm thinking of, you know, let's say the U.S. Supreme Court does do away with Roe v. Wade and it goes against precedent. I mean, first of all, are these Federalist judges that are now being appointed by President Trump around the country, are they likely to go against precedent? Are they likely to say, go ahead.
Yes, I think they are. There was actually a recent case about a very technical issue that involved just this point in which the conservative majority reversed an earlier decision, and the key issue was the degree to which precedent would be respected. So I think even with a 5-4 court, the conservatives are likely to undo Roe v. Wade. I think that is already likely to happen. It may happen step by step, or it may happen in one decision. But I think that's already very likely to happen. When I think about the potential of a 7-2 court, I'm really thinking about things that go beyond that. And I think that's where we could see a very significant change. You look at what's happening at the Environmental Protection Agency right now. You look at what's happening, you know, in various other agencies, and we're seeing just a tremendous reversal in the way the government works. And frankly, it's a reversal that across the board is much more favorable to corporate interests and much less favorable to consumers and to citizens in other respects.
Paul Starr is our guest. His book is Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. He is the co-founder of the American Prospect magazine, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Is there a danger, though, of pushback? Let's say that the president and his allies go too far on the question of abortion. Or, you know, let's say that under climate change, and you mentioned it, and our last guest mentioned it, let's say that Miami Beach goes underwater. And people finally wake up, and the climate change deniers wake up and say, "Oh my word, it's really true." You know, now we've gone too far. Does that help to rile up or empower the opponents of this kind of authoritarian populism that President Trump represents?
Well, some of those changes you just mentioned, you know, are probably not going to happen for quite a while. So the consequences are not immediate. They may be dire, and in fact, in the case of climate change, I think they would be dire for Florida. I mean, look at the maps of what the world will look like with 2 degrees of warming or 4 degrees of warming, and as you go up that level, Florida disappears. I mean, the stakes for Floridians are enormous here. I mean, if those terrible things happen, people will be very angry. But they ought to be angry now. They ought to be alarmed now. They ought to be thinking about it now and making judgments about it now.
One last question. It seems like President Trump is a great salesman, and he sold something that wasn't a traditional Republican idea. He reached out to workers in the Midwest, and he said he's going to put up tariffs, which is against the free trade policies of the Republican Party. That he was a salesman, and then it turns out he's not able to do a lot of the stuff he promised. I don't think that word has gotten into Fox News, but a lot of people that are paying attention to it realize jobs are not coming back to the U.S., and the trade war is not really helping American farmers. But what do the Democrats need to put up next year in order to beat Trump? Do they put up a salesperson, or how do they beat Trump next year?
Oh, I think just telling the truth is really the best thing to do. I'm not going to offer any political advice. Really, this book that I've written, Entrenchment, is a book about history. It's a book about politics. It looks back to the struggles over the power of concentrated wealth through our past. And as we've been talking about, I'm very concerned about the choices now, but I'm not gonna presume to give advice right now to the Democrats in 2020.
We still got that power of concentrated wealth, and some people think that even the Democratic Party, the establishment of the Democratic Party, kowtows too much to concentrated wealth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no doubt an influence in both parties, but I think there's also a significant difference between the parties in this respect. In the Republican Party, the influence of wealth fits exactly with the ideology of the party. In the Democratic Party, more favorable to labor interests, to higher minimum wage, and so forth. There's a tension. There's a conflict. There's a battle going on right now.
Well, Paul Starr, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. It's great to have you here. And do you have a website, Paul?
Yes, it's just at Princeton. If you just Google my name with Princeton University, you'll find it.
All right, Paul Starr, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thanks,
Paul. Paul is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the co-founder and founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction and the Bancroft Prize in American history. He's out with a new book called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Thanks, Ed Green. He's been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Nola LaLay is back. He'll be on the Midpoint program. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.